Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
And welcome, everybody. Welcome, welcome. Well, my second guest today is the author of Ocean Country. You may remember Liz Cunningham, who joined us last month to talk about the state of the oceans. And today, 140 world leaders kick off the UN Climate Conference 2015 in Paris. Many are calling it the 12 days that will decide the Earth's future. So we'll take a look at some of the people and innovative solutions leading the way at that summit and what's going on around the country and the world. And signs are good that if we act now, we can make a difference. And that's true, too, for my first guest. Did you know that there are only two great mammal migrations left on the planet, or that we've already lost our first dolphin to extinction as a direct result of human activity? Well, my first guest has been a household name since his 1968 bestseller, The Population Bomb. He is, of course, Paul Ehrlich, senior fellow at Stanford Woods Institute for the Environment and Bing Professor of Population Studies. He has written more than 40 books, and his latest is co-authored with Gerardo Ceballos. I'm sure I'm butchering these names, but you can put me right, Paul, when I bring you on, and Anne Ehrlich. And the book takes a powerful look at what the writers call the sixth mass extinction and what we can do to save needless loss. It's called The Annihilation of Nature, Human Extinction of Birds and Mammals. Paul Ehrlich, welcome.
It's nice to be there, and you did a pretty good job on Gerardo Ceballos.
Oh, there we go.
Others have done much worse.
I forgot the silent H, the silent G there. but these are colleagues of yours that you work with. You wrote this book together, and it's been described as this. I saw a couple of reviews on it, and it's an awesome book, by the way. It kept me up, and the bags under my eyes are partly due to your book. It's your fault.
You look beautiful to me.
And it's called, one person said, three of today's most distinguished scientists, or conservationists if you prefer, tell stories of mammals and birds that we've lost. They've come together in a plea to halt the Earth's sixth mass extinction. And another wrote, it's a beautiful lament for the vanishing wildlife of our world, wrapped in a message of hope. So tell us how you would describe your book.
Well, we're very concerned, as I think most biological scientists are, with the loss of the other organisms on the planet, which are basically our life support systems. We are sawing off the limb that we're sitting on, and most people don't realize it. And one of the ways we hope to make people realize it was, first of all, to produce a beautiful book that shows exactly how interesting and beautiful and tells the story of some of the organisms that we're losing and the ones that we are most familiar with, that is birds and mammals. We relate to them more than, say, to the insects we're losing or the microorganisms and so on. And I don't mind pushing the book as a Christmas present because we paid for the pictures, but all of the royalties are going to support young scientists who are studying and working how to prevent the extinction. So we decided to combine gorgeous pictures with a very thorough description of how we got into the mess, what's going on, what are some of the interesting stories of things we're losing, and what we can do about it. And so I would describe the book as your ideal Christmas present because, A, it's beautiful. B, it tells you about an extremely important problem that's largely ignored. And C, we don't make a nickel on it at all. All of it basically goes to charity.
Yeah, and I would echo that. It would make a beautiful gift. I would have been pleased if somebody had given this to me as a gift. It is full of really awesome information. I thought I knew a lot about animals, but I found animals in here that I'd never even heard of. And so let's start with just looking at some of the things that we've lost. Gerardo wrote a paper, and I know that some of your work went into this paper too, about the, entering them a sixth mass extinction, and this was shocking to see that 100 times higher, we're losing animals at 100 times higher than the background rate. So what would normally take 800 to 10,000 years to lose these animals, we're losing in 100 years. And that's really shocking.
And what's even worse is we're losing populations of other animals at a rate that's probably 10,000 times the background rate. In other words, before a species goes extinct, you've got to wipe out every population of it. And sometimes the wiping out of populations is extremely serious for us. You've probably, to move away from birds and mammals, you've probably heard a lot about the honeybees. If we lose the honeybee populations in North America, it will cost us economically something like $18 billion annually, and it will greatly reduce the nutritive value of our food. And yet the honeybee as a species would not be extinct. It occurs over much of the old world as well, and South America. So losing populations is a very, very serious thing that's going on at even a higher rate than the species extinctions. But if you want to see the consequences for us, just think about the passenger pigeon, which we describe in the book and is one of the things that's already gone. It was possibly the most common bird on the planet in the 1850s. When we drove railroads into the Midwest, which was its stronghold, they were so easy to hunt that they were even used as live shooting Cape clay pigeons in eastern shooting galleries. And, of course, their squabs, their young, were a standard of the diet of people all over the country. They bred in colonies of many, many millions of individuals, and yet we wiped them out by the early 1900s. We did it by killing enough of them they could no longer form the huge breeding colonies they had to have. And one of the consequences is the upsurge of Lyme disease in human beings, because the passenger pigeons used to compete with the mice that are the source of the Lyme disease. And the mice have become much more common because they have many more acorns to eat because the passenger pigeons aren't eating them anymore.
Yeah. So for everyone who says, and there are people out there who say, well, it doesn't really affect me, it doesn't really matter, and it's just part of the normal process, this is speeded up beyond an unbelievable rate. And it definitely does. I mean, I read in about the disappearance of the African elephant in your book that is killed largely for tusks for wealthy Chinese. And that's led to increase of bacterial disease, you say, transmitted to humans because of loss of biodiversity again.
Yeah, there's just lots of examples. And, you know, when I first went to Africa in 1966, black rhinos were common. You saw them all over the place. You were afraid of being chased by them. Now they're virtually gone. The people in South Africa are moving them up to Botswana, the ones they have, because the Botswanans are better at protecting them. You know, there's still a chance to go to Africa if you've got the funds and take a look back into the Pleistocene, what the world was like before we took it over. Mm-hmm. And that's quickly disappearing, as along with the animals, of course, like the lions and the rhinos and the elephants and the forest elephants and so on.
Yeah.
But that's exotic. It means a lot to us right here in the good old United States.
I read... go ahead, sorry.
No, I was just going to say, we're losing the bats to a disease that apparently spelunkers travel around. It's a white nose disease. And people say, well, what the hell? Who cares about bats? They just make nests in your hair. Of course, they don't. What they do is eat the mosquitoes that carry all kinds of nasty viruses to us and eat the pests that compete with us for our crops.
Yeah. I say they're very necessary.
I hope so.
Well, a couple of things I'd not heard of. The Tasmanian orange-bellied parrot in the wild, only about 50 of those left. Pangolins, is it pangolin? I'd never heard.
Pangolin, yeah.
Yeah, I never heard of them, but the Chinese like them as a delicacy, and authorities recently seized 11 tons that were illegally taken and killed.
And these are not big animals. They're mammals, but their hair is fused into scales. They're sometimes called spiny or scaly anteaters. And they play important roles in ecosystems, but they, you know, in China, you can take a train and at every stop eat a different endangered animal. They're a significant source, as you have mentioned, of the loss of elephants because of the ivory trade, and of the loss of the rhinos because the rhinos, they believe that rhino horn is an aphrodisiac. One of the saddest stories is that many scientists thought that Viagra was going to save the rhinos because, of course, Viagra works and ground up rhino horn doesn't work.
Right.
But
right.
I heard last year that the traders, the people who are the commercial interface in the rhino horn business, are actually grinding Viagra into the rhino horn to make rhino horn work.
Yeah,
it's just the most disgusting thing I think I've ever heard in conservation.
Yeah, absolutely. And the amounts of money they're making from it is disgusting, but it's all for nothing. It's all for nothing.
It's all for nothing. And sadly, of course, the people who kill the rhinos are just very poor people. It's the trade and the other end that have to be stopped. China has to stop it.
Right.
And because you can't blame somebody who's trying to live on a dollar a day if they can make $2 a day hunting rhinos.
Right. And unless we appear to be picking on China here, but a lot of this stuff does disappear because of Chinese medicine belief and black market stuff. We lost the first dolphin I read in your book,
a
goddess of Yangtze.
Yeah. The oceans are in bad shape. And they're getting in worse shape all the time, of course, with acidification and so on. But the rivers flowing into the oceans and many times are making the oceans worse and making it tougher for things that lived in rivers like that dolphin. And these are dolphins are really interesting animals. That whole group are obviously extremely intelligent, communicate with each other and so on. And besides the fact that we're wiping out our life support systems, we're losing the only known living things in the universe besides us. And I think anybody who spent any time with them find other animals or plants absolutely fascinating. They have stories most people don't know. They are beautiful in many, many different ways. One of the things we hope that the annihilation of nature that the book will bring home to people, that these things are not only working parts of our life support systems, but they're things that are beautiful, interesting, and very valuable to us in that way. Just think of all the people who are nature lovers, who are bird watchers, who raise tropical fishes in aquariums, and so on. People really get along with other organisms and value them, but we don't value them enough, and our government doesn't pay enough attention to preserving them. For instance, Mexico has a much better and more effective system of protecting its biodiversity than we have.
Well, let's hold that thought and let's talk about what they're doing that's better than what we're doing. When we come back, we have to take a very quick break here. And my guest is Paul Ehrlich. The book is called The Annihilation of Nature, Human Extinction of Birds and Mammals. And it's a really awesome book full of pictures and great information. You can see if you're watching on the camera, it's just chock full of pictures. All right, we'll take a very quick break. We'll be right back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
This is an encore edition of Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Vicky returns with a new show next week. Thanks for tuning in, and be sure and tune in every Monday at noon for Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
All right, everybody in the car, let's go.
What are we going to do first when we get there, Mom? Go for a hike?
Sure.
What about canoeing? Can we go canoeing too?
I don't see why.
How long does it take to get to the forest?
It's not that far, sweetie.
Are we there yet?
Yep, we're here.
Already?
It's a short drive from your neighborhood to your naturehood. Visit discovertheforest.org to find a neighborhood park or green space near you. Brought to you by the Ad Council and the U.S. Forest Service.
Coming up Monday, May 23rd on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, theater correspondent for The New Yorker and biographer of her, The Making of Meryl Streep, Michael Shulman. Tune in every Monday at noon Pacific time on Seattle's Alternative Talk, 1150 AM at FM 98.9 HD Channel 3. Find more than 300 podcasts and topics from health and mental wellness to travel, adventure, business, and the environment at conversationslive.net.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Listen to podcasts of past shows at conversationslive.net.
Following the herd is fine until they lead you off a cliff. Think for yourself. Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
And welcome back, everyone. You are listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, and my special guest in this segment is Paul R. Ehrlich. He's got a great book out written with Gerardo Chabalis and Anne Ehrlich. It's called The Annihilation of Nature, Human Extinction of Birds and Mammals, and it's full of pictures. And Paul, tell us where the proceeds, all of the proceeds of the book go to.
They go to the Rocky Mountain Biological Lab Fund for Navjot Saadi, who started the book with us and then unfortunately died, a young, brilliant conservation biologist, maybe the outstanding conservation biologist in Southeast Asia.
Very good.
And we miss him.
Yes, yeah. Well, what a great project to, remember him by, because there's some great information in here. And we were talking before the break about what Mexico is doing. I wanted to just touch on the fact that you mentioned in the book there are only two great mammal migrations left on the planet, which is unbelievable.
Well, one is the caribous in the north of our hemisphere,
yep.
And one is the wildebeest or gnus in the Serengeti in Africa. And the latter one has been threatened by plans to build highways across their route. And the reason for building the highways is to exploit the rare earths of the Congo and other places. And so, again, as John Holdren, the president's science advisor, said, we're ignoring the main push that's causing this. That is the scale of the human enterprise, the number of people and how much we consume. And, of course, much of what we consume now in the form of cell phones and very high-tech steels and so on depend on rare earths. And they're scattered in a very few places, and this animal migration may be destroyed by the need for rare earths in an expanding economy.
Yeah.
We are pushing away. We are out overcoming the creation with our own expansion.
And a great example of that is the dolphin that we lost, that we talked about just before the break. That was
exactly a
direct result of human activity.
Yeah.
So
we're the cause.
Yes. So you mentioned that Mexico is doing actually a much better job than we are.
They have a government agency called CONABIO, which actually keeps track of what's happening with their biodiversity all the time, encourages citizens to work on it, produces manuals and so on so that people can identify the things. And my colleague Gerardo Ceballos, who's the senior author of the book, has personally created reserves of many thousands of acres, and they're doing a very good job of putting aside land and working with local peoples to preserve their biodiversity. And there's nothing equivalent in the United States, where, of course, we have a dysfunctional Congress. So we just don't do what we should be doing.
And what should we be doing?
We should be paying. First of all, you're never going to solve this or any of our other environmental problems unless we reduce the scale of the human enterprise. In other words, the planet might be able to permanently support at a lifestyle that people listening to this program would accept if there were about a billion people on it. And we have 7.3 billion now, and the plans are, if you agree with the projections, to add 4 billion more by the end of the century. That is, by the end of this century, we'll add more than two times the number of people that were on the planet when I was born. So the first thing you've got to do is get family planning and reduction of wasteful consumption on the top of our political agenda. And if you've listened to the Republican debates, you know that no single issue has even been mentioned that's important. So it's a very depressing time in a political time where the only solutions are political.
So as voters, I mean, we have elections coming up, you know, how do we cut through some of the BS? What specifically should we be asking of people?
I think people should join in a movement to get pressure from the ground up on our politicians. And the way to do that, one way, is to join the mob. Go to mahb.stanford.edu. mahb.stanford.edu. Take you 2 minutes to join. Doesn't cost a thing, but it's trying to coordinate the activities of civil society to make sure that every single person is involved in at least getting the main things done. If you're interested in better housing for the poor, great. But if you don't work on the big issues that are, for example, population growth causing climate change, there's not going to be housing for anybody. So everybody should be getting together on the big issues, and one of those is doing the things that will help us save biodiversity. And right now, at this moment, the best thing there is to work very hard to prevent climate change from getting even worse, because climate change, of course, is a very big factor in causing extinctions.
Yes, and of course, with a big conference going on this week,
exactly,
we're hoping,
in Paris,
hoping to see some significant change there, or commitment. There is good news. I also read in your book that more than 500 species have been found during the last 10 years. But of course, we've got to keep these going, right?
We don't know for sure how many species there are on the planet and where all of them are. There are not enough. After all, we're talking about hundreds of millions to billions of organisms, and so there aren't enough biologists to study it. But as I've often said, you don't have to have named and identified every grain of sand to know that the beach is eroding. In other words, what's crystal clear to biologists is we are well into the sixth mass extinction, the first one that's occurred since there were people on the planet. Interestingly enough, it's the people that are causing it and cutting off their own life support systems. Mm-hmm. And so this has to be very high on the political agenda. And the way to tackle that is to just look at the scale of our activities. Do we really need to have a new cell phone every week at the cost, say, of the migration of the gnus? And it's a question everybody can answer for themselves.
Yeah. Well, the book is called The Annihilation of Nature, Human Extinction of Birds and Mammals. And you're a very well-renowned conservationist. But as a man, just a family man, what is your primary concern?
My primary concern, actually, is what kind of world my great-grandchildren, who already exist, are going to be able to live in. Probably my grandchildren, too. We are stealing from the future. If you care about children, then you want to be sure that we don't end up having so many of them they can't have decent lives.
And what is, at the moment, as far as animal extinction, what is the number one priority? There are so many priorities out there, I'm guessing it's almost impossible.
There are lots of priorities, but I would say number one at this moment is to push on the politicians to make even bigger commitments to dealing with greenhouse gases and preventing us from heating the planet to the point where we and most of the mammals on the planet will not be able to have decent lives.
Okay. And so I'm going to give you an opportunity here to speak directly to those, because I know a lot of our audience, we're preaching to the choir here, but it's all good information to go out and spread around. But to those who really just don't get what a difference this makes to them, what do you say?
What I say is it's high time we, as part of our society, we paid more attention to what's going to happen to our grandchildren and great-grandchildren. We are wrecking the planet as a life support system for our descendants. And if you care at all about your children on down, then you should educate yourself on this issue. Buy the book and read it, and join the mob, mahb.stanford.edu, and join other citizens who are trying to, despite the politicians, keep our planet habitable for human beings and our kind of society.
Well, Paul Ehrlich, I really appreciate you being with us today. Appreciate your expertise, and I loved this book. It would make a fabulous gift book. We've got holidays coming up. It's called The Annihilation of Nature, Human Extinction of Birds and Mammals. And there are some really great pictures in here, but some really awesome information that I've never seen anywhere else before. So I appreciate you being here with us today, Paul.
My great pleasure, and happy holidays to all of you.
And to you. And go rest your voice now. I know you've been suffering.
Thank you. You too.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye. All right. We are going to take a very quick break. And when we come back, we'll be joined by Liz Cunningham. And we'll be taking a look at climate change and a little about what's happening over in Paris right now and some other great stuff that's happening. Please stay with us. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
I see a winter, a very cold winter of the future.
Let's see if I guess that this just isn't working.
Knowing you have a great idea for a book is one thing, writing it another. So what's stopping you? Maybe you can't find time. Maybe you don't know where to begin. Maybe you wrote a couple of chapters, then disappeared down a rabbit hole. Or maybe you'd rather someone else write it for you. Partnering with the right coach or ghostwriter can make all the difference between talking about your book and finishing your book. As an award-winning writer and strategic consultant, Vicky St. Clair's storytelling credits span from business, health, self-help, and memoir to New York Times and USA Today best-selling anthologies. Vicky partners with people just like you at the exact level you need. Whether you need a little encouragement, editorial guidance, or full-blown ghostwriting and consulting services. If you're serious about telling the story you know is inside you, stop procrastinating. Let's get your story down on paper. Contact Vicky today. Email Vicky at VickySt.Clair.com or call 1-800-495-7617. See more about Vicky and her work at VickySt.Clair.com.
Oh, yeah, that could work.
This is Martha Norwalk. Every Sunday morning, beginning at 9 a.m., thanks in part to the Ananda Institute of Living Yoga, we cover the world of animals. This week, May 15th, it's a Behavior Training and Healing Sunday with me. We'll have open phone lines throughout the show. As an animal behavior therapist and trainer, I can help you resolve any issues you have with your animal friends. I'll answer all your questions. Plus, it's your chance to talk about any animal-related topics on your mind. Martha Norwalk's Animal World, Sunday morning, 9 a.m. to noon, right here on Alternative Talk, AM 1150.
Coming up Monday, May 23rd on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, theater correspondent for The New Yorker and biographer of her, The Making of Meryl Streep, Michael Shulman. Tune in every Monday at noon Pacific time on Seattle's Alternative Talk 1150 AM and FM 98.9 HD Channel 3. Find more than 300 podcasts on topics from health and mental wellness to travel, adventure, business, and the environment at conversationslive.net.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Follow me on Twitter at Vicky St. Clair.
Remember, you're listening to Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
Computers, nature polluters, no more destroyers. No more construction, mindless consumption, no garbage dumping.
If only. Welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, and we just talked with Paul Ehrlich about his great book, The Annihilation of Nature, Human Extinction of Birds and Mammals. And I wanted to let you know, in case you're interested, that it's also Big Cats Week on National Geographic Channel this week. They do an awesome job on Big Cats Week, so go there to find out what's happening there. And also the Discovery Channel is running a series. It's starting a series this Wednesday called Racing Extinction. All very awesome photography and great information there. All right, I'm very pleased now to be joined again by Liz Cunningham. She's a writer and author dedicated to raising awareness around ocean conservation and climate change. And she's also the founder of KurtHahn.org, which is the archive for the founder of Outward Bound. And Liz joined us back in October to talk about her book, Ocean Country, One Woman's Journey from Peril to Hope in Her Quest to Save the Seas. And today we're looking at people and solutions that are striving to make a difference Let's bring you on. Liz Cunningham, welcome.
Hi, it's great to be with you, Vicky.
I'm very pleased to have you here. And of course, the UN Climate Conference 2015 began today in Paris. There are 140 world leaders in attendance with around 40,000 attendees made up of diplomats, experts, scientists and advocates. And as I said earlier at the top of the hour, many are calling the conference the 12 days that will decide the Earth's future. Do you wish you were there, Liz?
No, I'm happy to be where I am. And I think that wherever you are, you can dig your heels in and roll up your sleeves and be making a difference.
I love it. I love it. Well, scientists say just one more degree of warming and we'll be facing serious consequences. But over the years, we've heard so much about climate change and so much. We've heard facts and figures. We've heard hyperbole. We've heard flat out denial that there is climate change. And so it's no wonder that, you know, some people roll their eyes and think, oh, here we go again when the topic comes up. But you write an article for Green Biz. You say for decades, the dialogue on the state of our planet has been riddled with mind-numbing catastrophe speak. Nuclear winter, population bombings, killing the Earth. It's been that cultural seesaw between hope and despair. But you talk a lot about hope. So tell us your viewpoint on that.
Well, I think a lot of what's happening in our public dialogue right now is what I call a tale of two truths. And we have the truth of destruction, but we are missing the truth of our capacity to do something about it. And I think over the past couple decades, you know, I've been alive, we've had these apocalypse scenarios. And at the same time, I think we've had a sense of a loss of collective mission. What we need now is to bring that mission to the forefront. And there's nothing like a good crisis to give you a strong sense of mission and a sense of self-discovery. I think what we need now is a very strong sense of collective mission. And that mission is, it's innovation, but it really is about restoring the Earth and saying we have to re-habit our habitat, and we need to roll up our sleeves and get to work restoring it.
Right. Well, this is the 21st climate negotiation meeting since 1992. Others have failed, but there seems to be a lot of optimism around this. Many say because it's really our last chance. What do you hope to see come out of this?
I think that we will get an agreement. Well, what I hope for, well, I think I'm going to back that off. I think that I've already adjusted my hopes. And many people have as well. They see that we are not going to get a definitive agreement that is going to solve this problem. It's a long-term problem. But what I do hope to see is what they had planned, which is to get a lot of people on board participating and making change in these different countries. Also, I hope to see this issue get to the forefront of our body politic and stay there.
Right.
That this challenge is now prominent in our minds.
Well, I did hear that all countries are now being held accountable. They've all got to come up with their own plans, whereas it used to be just, you know, the well-developed countries, which resulted in many of them walking away from the table. Now that everybody's being held accountable, then we hope things will change. Interestingly enough, I heard this morning, since the convention's being held in Paris, that Paris was more smog-filled in the summer last year than Shanghai. Can you believe that?
Absolutely. You know, last night my husband and I watched the movie Amazing Grace, which is about William Wilberforce, who was anti-abolitionist and who helped end slavery. And, you know, if you have that feeling of here we begin another summit, well, that's what happened over and over again in England. And finally, he did succeed. And we need to remind ourselves that sometimes it takes many, many efforts before you really get something done.
Right. So I want to look at some of the good things that are going on, because you mentioned to me before some people who are really starting to make a difference. And one of them is Mark Z. Jacobson and colleagues at Stanford University who are working on some great solutions, which sound very feasible, and they're the first people I understand to come up with any kind of project of this kind. So I wonder if you'd shed some light on what's happening there.
Sure, and I want to point out before talking about him that, you know, there's been a lot of what is called pseudo-studies and pseudo-science and pseudo-truths floated by think tanks that are funded by the fossil fuel industry. And one of those is very, very sticky, which is saying, you know what, there just aren't any alternatives to fossil fuels. It's really important to see that a lot of us have had a hard time imagining how we're going to move our civilization forward and get off of fossil fuels. So one of these plans is by Mark Jacobson at Stanford University, and he has drawn up a plan state by state for the United States to get to 100% clean renewable energy by 2050. And it is very nuts and bolts. He's gone through each state and seen what percentage is gas, what percentage is coal, what percentage is fossil fuel, and what available technologies, for instance, in the Midwest, you know, wind power would be big. And each one, he's created a plan. As he's doing this, the fossil fuel industry is lobbying bit by bit, you know, moving along with him and trying to detract people from his point of view. But he's made tremendous progress, and it shows, no, there's a plan, we can do this. And it's like the national highway system. It's like set a goal, look what we need to do, and then place the resources into place and get us into gear to make it happen.
And so some of this, he says, we did this across all 50 states. We saw a 39% reduction in total end user power by the year 2050. That's pretty significant, and it's not that far away either.
No, and it's already there. I mean, if you drive along in California, you'll see solar panels on roofs, and the price of solar energy has dropped 70% in the last decade. So a lot of this is going to be cheaper. And one of the other kind of subtle arguments that, you know, we don't have fossil fuels, our culture, our country will be less secure. Well, solar energy is decentralized, and one of the main targets for terrorism are our power plants. So, you know, decentralized energy in this way is actually more secure from a political standpoint.
Right, right. Well, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, I want to continue talking about some of these solutions that are out there, because there are many of them and many things that we could be doing on a grassroots level, too, to make a difference. My guest is Liz Cunningham. Her book is called Ocean Country, One Woman's Voyage from Peril to Hope in Her Quest to Save the Seas. And you are listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. We'll be right back.
Sky wavering and burning like a golden light. I fell so far.
Looking for unconditional love, an exercise buddy, or a great listener? Paws has the dog or cat of your dreams, just waiting to meet you. We've made thousands of perfect matches since 1967, because everyone needs a warm, safe place to call home. Find out more today at paws.org. or call 425-787-2500.
It only takes a minute to find out if you may have prediabetes, and you can do it at doihaveprediabetes.org. But you're probably not going to, are you? Kids, work, listening to the radio. You're busy, which is great because busy people can't get prediabetes. Oh my, I read that wrong. They can. Should have worn my glasses. So visit doihaveprediabetes.org and take a short test, because prediabetes can be reversed.
Brought to you by the Ad Council and its Prediabetes Awareness Partners.
Let's see if I guess that this just isn't working.
Knowing you have a great idea for a book is one thing, writing it another. So what's stopping you? Maybe you can't find time. Maybe you don't know where to begin. Maybe you wrote a couple of chapters, then disappeared down a rabbit hole. Or maybe you'd rather someone else write it for you. Partnering with the right coach or ghostwriter can make all the difference between talking about your book and finishing your book. As an award-winning writer and strategic consultant, Vicki St. Clair's storytelling credits span from business health, self-help, and memoir to New York Times and USA Today best-selling anthologies. Vicki partners with people just like you at the exact level you need. Whether you need a little encouragement, editorial guidance, or full-blown ghostwriting and consulting services. If you're serious about telling the story you know is inside you, stop procrastinating. Let's get your story down on paper. Contact Vicki today. Email Vicki at VickiSt.Clair.com or call 1-800-495-7617. See more about Vicki and her work at VickiSt.Clair.com.
Oh, yeah.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Find out about upcoming shows at conversationslive.net.
Going against the grain has never been so much fun. Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
And welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. My guest is Liz Cunningham. She is the author of Ocean Country. And we're talking about, a bunch of stuff today to do with climate change and what's going on, some of the solutions and the people and the Paris conference. But Liz, you sent me something on some solutions that Project Drawdown.org, I just wanted to make sure I got their website right. Drawdown.org is working on, they're developing a book, an open source database, digital platform describing how 100 solutions at scale can alter the composition of our atmosphere. I mean, there's a lot of very innovative stuff going on right now.
Yeah, and I think one of the most important things about this distress is that some of the things which would be used to combat climate change or even eventually help cool the Earth down, some of these solutions make the world a better place in other ways. For instance, population control seems to many people to be this really intransigent problem. But if you educate women in the developing world, you will have population control because their preferences generally are to have less women, less babies, and then that means also they're more educated. Very often those women will start small businesses. That's just a plus in our culture as a whole.
It's a huge thing, this educating women. Let's stay on this for a second, because in countries where they don't have opportunity to learn and to go to school, that they're so hungry for it. That I've known people, I knew one woman who used to say, you know, if you've got a spare laptop lying around, or if you can afford, go buy yourself a new one and give me your old one. She was taking them over to Turkey at one point,
right,
and giving them to the women, the young girls, and so they could get education. And I heard this morning that Japan is in serious economic condition because women tend not to go back to work after they've had their children. And
yep.
So there's a lot of pressure over in Japan right now to get women to go back to work once they've had kids. So, but educating women, those are educated women for the large part in Japan, because many of them have university degrees, but we're talking in countries where they just don't have opportunities like that.
I think one of the things that's important when we look at this too is there's sort of a way of thinking where we get overwhelmed by the problems. We go, look at all these problems, they're so overwhelming. But we have to remember that there are certain solutions, when you put them in place, they're going to have multiple positive impacts. And that's where you get that synergy, where you can get an uptick and you start to see a lot of social change happening. And we need to remember that we have the capacity and the potential to do that.
Yeah. I love this quote by Paul Hawken. Climate change is begging you to dream, not hide. It's time to come together and collaborate. And if people did come together and dreamed, as he said, I'm sure there would be some incredible solutions from that effort.
I think there's a good parallel to the decade-long challenge to put a man on the moon. Say, let's put the best of us to work to meet this challenge. Let's have this be, you know, our finest hour. And, you know, is that too glib? I don't think so. I think we've gone through decades of apocalypse speak and a negative, despairing view of politicians and our leadership, but I think that the pendulum may swing in the opposite direction. And in a lot of ways, I always like to quote Linda Ellaby, the broadcast journalist. She said that, you know, lack of alternatives clears the mind wonderfully. And a lot of ways, yeah, we don't have a choice. We have to get it together.
That's very true. Well, they say that we've definitely crossed into, we're seeing the highest amount of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere for all of human history. So you have a lot of knowledge around what they call blue sinks. So let's talk a little bit about that. But and what's going on with seagrasses, with mangroves. We hear a lot about the Amazon forest, and I think we touched a little on this last time we talked, but there are other solutions. You know, yes, we don't want the Amazon forest to go, but there are other solutions that we can grow quickly that eat up emissions very rapidly.
Right, yeah. And, you know, sometimes people come up to me and they explain to me these different technological fixes for climate change. And the other day someone came up and told me there was a plan to dump sort of powdered lead out of airplanes into the air.
Great. Okay. And I hope they got that wrong.
Yeah, I do. And I was thinking about it, and there are a lot of solutions which at this moment are somewhat invisible, but they also have these multiple positive effects. And I know that WWF, the Worldwide Fund for Nature, is working on this in Southeast Asia because there are so many small island nations. And one of them is replanting mangroves. Mangroves store 50 times more carbon in their soil than the same amount of Amazon rainforest. They are very powerful carbon sinks. I think, okay, well, all right, so what, we're going to just plant a lot of mangroves? Well, first, we can stop ripping them out. I think it's 1 or 2 football fields a day that are lost.
Wow.
If you plant mangroves in island nations, they have multiple positive effects. They're nurseries for juvenile fish. They stabilize sediment in water. That means you get better water quality. And they also protect islands from extreme weather. I was in Sulawesi in August in a tiny village, Bohowo, in North Sulawesi. They had been given some funds by the national park. They chose to do 2 things, to drill a well and to plant mangroves. And I saw there were like 3,000 mangroves that the village had planted. Why did they do it? Because they knew that was going to protect their village.
Yeah, there's a lot of wetlands being built or could be built instead of just straightforward parklands too. And you mentioned one that is being planned in San Francisco Bay area right now.
That's a fantastic program that's going on here in the San Francisco Bay because we're very aware that we're going to have rising sea levels and we're thinking, oh my God, what's going to happen with that? And it would be the same thing. By planting seagrass here, you would be stabilizing sediment. You would be supporting fish populations in the bay. You would also be creating habitats for birds and all kinds of other creatures. And in addition, you're also as well, again, stabilizing sediment in the water and helping the water quality to improve.
Yeah, a lot we can do in small ways. Several years ago, I went up to Churchill, Manitoba, where the polar bears are out on the tundra and until the ice freezes over. And I know when I was up there, it was probably 10, maybe a little bit longer, maybe 12 years ago. And we were up there at the beginning of November, and that was considered very late for the polar bears still to be on land. But the water had not frozen over yet for them to get out on the sea, on the bay. And it was such a moving experience. I mean, it remains to this day one of the most moving experiences of my life to see those wild polar bears out there on the tundra. And so I was wondering what was happening with them today. And so I Googled it yesterday. And they have, I don't know if you know this, but they have what they call polar bear jail for, for when the polar bears wander into town. They capture them and they put them into jail for a little while. But they're getting, I think they had 22 last week that were jailed or 22 in jail right now because the ice, we're at the end of November now and it hasn't frozen over. And the issue there is that, of course, they can't get out and they can't fish properly and they can't eat properly. And it's kind of disheartening to see that, you know, when you love animals so much and then you get these people on the other side saying there's no such thing as climate change. Well, you've just got to go up there and see what's happening.
I think that looking back into history, it would be a very important note of geography that where climate change has been most visible is not where the decision makers are. I think if Washington were in the Arctic or Washington were at the equator, things would move faster.
Yeah, that's a plan. Maybe we should suggest that.
Yeah.
We'll get it on the ballot. Stick them up in the Arctic so they can see what's going on.
I think it also is important to say, and many people, Naomi Klein among them, and Rebecca Solnit, I have to, of course, mention their voices. Many people have said, okay, we're not going to have a march in Paris because of terrorism, but it's really important to note the enormous amount of destruction, and in that case, violence, that has been reaped from climate change, and that includes deaths of people and deaths of creatures and deaths of habitats. And for some reason, those events have not been assigned the priority that terror has. And yet at the same time, anybody who went through Hurricane Katrina or Hurricane Sandy, they would say, look, this is just as important.
Right, right. So you talk to a lot of people throughout the course of your work, and I know you're very optimistic about it. Everything I've read for the people, the delegates going into the Paris convention or conference, climate conference today, they were all on the optimistic side. Many said because we have to be optimistic, it's our last chance. But what's your sense when you're out and about talking to people?
I think that we still have not got it. And I don't know if I even totally get it. I think that even over the last week, I think I am getting it more, the enormity of this crisis. So I don't want to criticize other people because I'm still aware that my ignorance is quite high as well. So I'll talk about the unraveling of my ignorance. I think that 10 years ago, I thought, yeah, it's an issue. 5 years ago, I went, wow, I didn't realize how big of an issue it is. And in the last 2 years, I realized this could be bigger than World War II, much bigger. It could be bigger than World War II and the Depression combined in terms of the quantity of death and damage and destruction. And it's a huge tidal wave that's coming, and we really need to mobilize and connect and invest on new technologies that will help us turn this around.
And so what's your call for action to people? Do you have an organization you're affiliated with who is leading the way on that?
I think my call for action to people is to simply engage on issues more and look at their lives and see what's possible. In my own life, I've asked myself as a writer, what if I lived as if my voice matters? That's such a simple question, but I realize, wow, I'm not doing it. So if you could go from that assumption and say, what if I lived as if my voice mattered? Would I sign a petition? Would I bring this up at the dinner table? Would I start talking to other people? Would I ask myself, what could I do, even though I'm busy and I'm just trying to get through the rest of the day, what could I do? And I think rather than giving people a laundry list, you should do this, you should do that,
right,
I really invite them to engage the issue and look for what's possible, because a lot of us are just trying to get through the day and say, okay, where's the window? What could I do?
I love it. Love it, love it. And I know listeners can find out more about you, Liz, at lizcunningham.net, correct?
Yes.
All right. Well, I want to thank you for being with us today. Really appreciate your time. And you know, like you, my unraveling has been somewhat slow. But I got a big jolt this weekend when I was doing my research for today's show. It is a serious situation and we do need action. Just 1 degree. That's all our planet has to heat up, 1 degree centigrade. And we are in serious, serious trouble. So I do hope they come up with some great solutions at this big conference. Thanks for being with us, Liz.
Thank you, Vicky.
And you can find out more about Liz and her book, Ocean Country, at lizcunningham.net. And again, just to give out the website that Paul Ehrlich shared with you too, it's mahb.stanford.edu. Sign up there and be part of the movement. Thank you so much for being with us today. Really appreciate your time. If you've got feedback or comments, you can find me at info@conversationslive.net or 800-495-7617, 800-495-7617. Thanks for being with us. We'll see you next week. And this week, we're going on an adventure. Live well, live strong.
Hi, this is Vicky St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772.